hard to find. Sure found it hard to find mine.
All right, we're moving on to the next Journey segment. We very rarely have them, and now we have like three on this show. It's a pretty crazy day today, but you know, I've been told that I need to have more because when I'm speaking to people just about what they're going through, the listeners seem to like the real stuff, right? The messy lives.
Yes.
Messy lives with hopefully a real God in the middle of it. Michelle is a young mom whose entire world shifted in June 2011 when her two-year-old daughter was diagnosed with an aggressive brain tumor and given just months to live. Michelle and her wife, Amy, were determined that if they couldn't add days to her life, they would add life to her days and learn the true meaning of living like there is no tomorrow. And when Stella died, the magical funeral Michelle and her family experienced inspired her to actually enter into the funeral profession. So, you know, she could actually make a difference in the lives of others. The same way the funeral directors made a difference for her. So joining us on the phone, all the way from an undisclosed location near the Marshall Cottage. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, how are you today?
What's the weather up there like, by golly?
It's cold, and the sun keeps trying to peek out, but it's just teasing us right now.
All right. Michelle, you know, you've told your story a million times. As a matter of fact, I watched a video the other day, and it looks like your story is part of a documentary that's coming out that looks at how we deal with death and grief in the Western world and how it's changed over the last century, why many people are now opting for funerals that are more personal and yet, you know, innovative in their approach to the funeral. And this film focuses on Amy and you, who, of course, lost your daughter Stella mm-hmm. Joy at the age of 3.5. So what happens to you every time you tell a story? Does it become less and less emotional for you, or is it always the same? You know, people react differently when they share the story so many times.
You know, for me, I still cry every single time I tell it. I think that through the telling and retelling of it, it's almost become mythical in a way, just in the way that sort of, you know, stories do over time. They shift and you've got your beginning and your middle and your end. So I think that the story itself has evolved into something sort of smooth that you can, you know, has a beginning and a middle and an end. But the emotion of it, and every time that I speak about Stella, that I tell the story, I go back to that place. And it's really difficult, actually. I have to really psych myself up every time that I talk about Stella, because it's still very raw, still very very emotional, very sad for me. So I think telling and retelling it over and over again doesn't take the emotion away, but what it does is it creates sort of a more complete story in a way.
I would imagine that retelling the story of losing a child helps you hang on to your child.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, not just for parents who lose children, but for anybody who loses anyone or anyone who even knows they're dying themselves, the fear is that they'll be forgotten. I think that's why so many people fear death. So for me and of course my wife Amy, telling Stella's story over and over again, sharing her with more people, keeping her name and her story out there is our sort of duty we feel as parents, to make sure that she isn't forgotten, and that, you know, just because she only lived 3.5 years, her life still mattered, and it was very important, and it changed lives. So for us, you know, getting to tell the story is really our way of honoring her and what she gave to us.
I never met Stella. What did I miss?
Well, she was a firecracker. She had, you know, curly red hair and a saucy smile and a personality to match. She was our first, and she really gave us a run for our money. She was mouthy. She was active. She would point her finger at anyone and say, "I don't like you," and narrow her eyes when she was like 2 years old. She didn't pull any punches. She wasn't, you know, she wasn't cute unless she needed to be for some reason, but she was very lively, and she really lived. Like, she just woke up every morning at 5 a.m., bright-eyed, raring to go, full of energy, and she just, like, ran through the 3.5 years she was alive. She just couldn't wait to get out there and live.
I wonder if she knew. I mean, you hear people ask that question, and I don't know, maybe we we read into things that aren't there, but I wonder if she knew.
You know, that's something that we've often talked about as well, my family, because we couldn't for the life of us figure out, you know, before she got diagnosed with her cancer, why she insisted on waking up every morning at 5 a.m. And we tried everything. Like, we Googled, we bought, you know, if it said helps children sleep, we bought it, we owned it, nothing.
So you had a lot of duct tape?
Oh my gosh. We had every accoutrement. We tried, you know, everyone's got advice. We tried sleep her on her back, on her front, move her bedtime earlier, move it later. But it didn't matter. She just had this boundless energy. She just wanted to run and live. And sometimes we talk about maybe, you know, somehow she knew her life was short, and so she was just fitting it all in, making it all matter.
Well, let's do the take us back stuff. The day that you wondered what was wrong.
So she... you know, she was just over 2 when she was diagnosed, and my wife and I noticed that she was kind of walking a little bit crooked, but at the same time, I had just bought her these really audacious foam sandals from Zellers that were like platform sandals for 2-year-olds. So Amy was convinced that these sandals were what were making her walk funny, and so went out and spent a fortune on different sandals, but she was still walking funny, and Amy was blaming me and saying, well, those sandals ruined her ability to walk. Like, she's had to teach herself how to walk funny now because of these cheap sandals that you bought her. So we sort of, you know, kind of laughed about it, thought it was sort of a joke, but then her daycare actually said to us, you know, her balance seems a bit off. She's dancing with her friends and she keeps falling over. Maybe you should get it looked at. So we, you know, we took her to her family doctor. The family doctor wasn't concerned. She said, oh, it's probably just an inner ear infection. You know, don't worry about it. But we were going away for the weekend. So we thought, well, you know what, let's take her into SickKids and just get this ear infection treated before we go away for the weekend. We had a wedding, and so we were leaving her with friends, and we didn't want her sick. So, you know, we walked into SickKids because she was up at 5 a.m. We were there at 5:20. There was nobody else there. And, we had both said, called into work and said, you know, we're taking her to the doctor, but we'll be in probably just after 9. And so we ended up walking into SickKids, and then they sort of just put us in a room, and then more and more doctors kept coming into this room.
Oh,
and
geez.
Then we had, you know, specialists, and we had all these people, and the hours were going by, and we still didn't know anything. They weren't telling us anything, but we started to get this bad feeling that it was more than an ear infection, because they kept having all these doctors rotating through, not telling us anything, but doing tests, making notes, and walking out. And then they said to us, oh, we'd like to do an MRI on her just to rule out anything more serious. Are you guys okay to spend the night at SickKids? And to be honest, Amy and I were like, well, no, we've been here all day. Like, it's been very challenging to keep her quiet for the day. I mean, you can't imagine, she was running up and down the halls, screeching through other people's rooms, yanking on IV poles. It was insane. But, you know, then we were like, oh, let's just get it over with. So they took her for an MRI at 11 o'clock that night. And at 2 in the morning, we were in the hospital bed sleeping. And this team of doctors literally marched in, turned on the lights, and said, oh, the MRI revealed that she has a mass in her brain. And we were like, what? Like, total shock. So I actually screamed and fainted. And then they had to call a code on me. So they had nurses rushing in. And I totally passed out. I didn't come to until I was actually across the street at Toronto General Hospital. And Amy stayed back with Stella. And then everything happened really quickly. Within 24 hours after that initial shocking announcement, they had diagnosed the type of cancer. It's called DIPG. It's cancer of the glioma, pontine glioma, which is at the base of your brain, and it's kind of the computer of the brain. So this particular tumor wraps itself around, and as it grows, it starts to cut off all of your faculties one by one, and they never really know what order they're going to lose their faculties in, but it was obvious Stella was going to lose her ability to walk first, because that was the first sign. So they basically said, you know, it's got 100% fatality. Most children die within 3 months, and during those 3 months, you'll watch her lose her faculties one at a time. She won't be able to walk and then talk. And then, you know, use her hands, and then one day it'll, it'll hit either her breathing or her heart, and then she'll die. And that was sort of it. So, you know, that was shocking because within 24 hours, we thought we had a child with an inner ear infection, and then she was given a fatal brain tumor diagnosis. But other than a little bit of stumbling walking, she was still 100% her. Like, she loved Sick Kids. She thought it was the greatest place in the world. There was toys. All of her family was there. She was getting balloons and ice cream. I mean, she just, you know, thought that she had just won the life lottery getting to be in this amazing hospital.
I am so not cool with this story. Like, just... not, okay. The background to this, and Tim already knows where I'm going with this conversation, is that I have... if there is a God, I have always had this long-standing argument with God, although it's not really an argument, it's just me. And it's, screw with me all you want, but you mess with one of my kids and you and I are done.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think that naturally when something like that happens, we all look to try to blame someone or something. I think that's natural because we're raised in a society where we're taught about justice and being just, and that if you do good things or if you're a good person, good things will happen to you. So when something like this happens to you and one of your children, and you know, you don't understand why, I think that the anger comes from the injustice, and you certainly are looking for something. And in this type of cancer, there was no person to blame because it wasn't caused by anything that we could trace back. It's not something that it's because you smoked or you drank when you were pregnant or you know, there was nothing. It's completely random. So I think that you do look to find anger somewhere, but for me, it wasn't God. I was just angry at the world. But I don't think that it made any sense to be angry with God, because if it's a random disease, then it's exactly that. It's random. I don't think that God ever creates any child and says, you know, and you will die at age 3. I think that, you know, something went wrong in her body when she was growing, and that's just, you know, unfortunately what happens sometimes.
You know, normally I'm better at this, Michelle. What were the progressing symptoms? What did you have to endure? What did you have to watch Stella go through?
Well, you know, I will definitely answer that question, but I want to preface it with the fact that we watched Stella do this, and we suffered, and our friends and family suffered, but Stella did not. Even though she was losing her faculties, she... because she was so young, didn't really have the ability to know what she was supposed to be doing or not doing. I mean, you think about a 2-year-old, they don't know really that they're supposed to be able to do X, Y, and Z. So what we had to endure was, first, she lost her ability to walk, and then she lost her ability to speak, which was very, very difficult for all of us. But she devised her own way of communicating. She would stick her tongue out. So we would say, you know, Stella, do you want a banana? If you want a banana, stick out your tongue. And so she would stick her tongue out to communicate with us. As she got weaker, her muscles actually started to fail her. And so through the months, she lost her ability to sit up. Like, her neck would just hang completely down if you didn't have her leaning back, so she would just slump over. And then she lost the ability to use her hands, any fine motor skills. And then eventually she couldn't really eat or chew or swallow very easily, so she would, you know, drool out the side of her mouth, and she would have trouble swallowing. So they gave her 3 months to live. She lived 16 months. So through that 16 months, we really... had to keep adjusting as her abilities diminished. We had to change how we were, you know, parenting her and what we did as far as activities were. But she remained, you know, she lost her ability to run and to laugh and to jump, but she never lost her ability to live. She would still wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning with that little gleam in her eye, and we would still say to her, you know, do you want to go to Riverdale Farm today to see the pigs? And she would stick her tongue out, yes, and we'd bundle her in the car and It would take four of us to kind of hold her neck up and hold her body so she could see something, but she would smile at the pigs. And, you know, it was quite amazing to see her living and continuing to live. And I always think that was such a blessing that she just, she never, you know, I think it's because she was so young. She never had any bitterness or anger. She just thought, well, this is, you know, this is how it is. And she just adapted to all of her new abilities. And it was really beautiful to watch. And she never lost her her smart aleckness either. I actually had to
put her nice catch.
Well, yeah, I took her to church on Palm Sunday, and you know how they hand everybody out palms?
Yes.
She spent the entire service with this jerky hand movement, smacking me in the face with her palm and laughing. Like, I was just like, I can't believe this. The kid can't talk. She can't walk. She can barely like hold something, and she just like put a smirk on her face and started smacking me in the face with this palm, and I thought, okay, here we go.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. You know, there's a part of me that wants to stay away from any sort of sensationalistic nonsense, but the reality is, part of you sharing this story, Michelle, is bringing us into the pain that you've gone through, but also that helps us understand the nuances of these difficulties. It kind of just it paints it. You're filling in the blanks for us because we've not lived your life, and mm-hmm. and it, look, it's the ultimate universal injustice when a child dies before the parent, and so the final day.
Mm-hmm.
Good night. I mean, I'm not. Are you okay with me asking you this?
Of course, absolutely. I consider sharing Stella's story to be one of the biggest honors of my life, so I'm happy to answer anything.
Cool. Okay. So where were you?
So Stella died at home. She had, you know, she had slowly been declining through the months and months, but there was a time that she sort of stopped waking up. She stopped eating, and, you know, her eyes got really gunky and her mouth got gunky. And so we knew she wasn't really very responsive anymore. And at that time, you know, we were really lucky throughout her entire illness. We had these great palliative care doctors, and the doctors came in and kind of said, well, you know, she's not eating anymore. She's not drinking. You know, she's actively dying. And, you know, we said, well, how long is it going to be? And they said, we don't really know, but the longest, like the absolute longest we've ever seen anyone go without food and water is 12 days. So Stella lived for 13 because that's the kind of kid she was.
Jeez. You know, and, if she didn't have that red hair, right?
Nice curly red hair. So she was in our bed. She lived in she was had been in our bed for several days, and you know, we kind of just held court around our bed. We had a constant stream of family and friends, and everyone would come and lie with her. And even though she wasn't really conscious, we read books through her, and we sang, and we spent time with her. And that the last couple days, it was very, very hard for Amy and I. She hadn't eaten in almost 2 weeks, so she was literally skin and bones, and we had to keep repeating what the doctors had told us, which is she's not dying because she's not eating. She's not eating because she's dying. But as the time got closer, you know, we knew what signs to look for. The doctors had told us. And at that point, we were so exhausted and we were so sad. We also, in the 16 months that she had been sick, we had had two other children. So we had these two babies. We had a one-year-old and a 10-week-old. So we were completely exhausted. And, you know, at one point, Amy pulled one of her socks off and noticed that her foot was blue. And as soon as we saw that, we knew that she was very close to death. So we gathered around her and we gathered our family and our friends and we just held her. And she took her last breath while she was wrapped in my arms and Amy's arms. So it was very reminiscent of when she was born. You know, we had ushered her into the world in our arms and then we ushered her out again. It was very peaceful for her. It was very sad for us, but obviously we knew it was coming. So we dressed her and we bathed her and then we dressed her. We washed her hair. And we laid her out on the bed with her favorite stuffed animal. And we called all of our closest family and friends to come. And we just gathered around the bed and we said our goodbyes. And we were very lucky. We had spoken to a funeral home earlier and we had told them that under no circumstances was our daughter going to be leaving our home in a black body bag, which is what we had been told happens when somebody dies at home. And we said, no way. And the funeral home complied. So when we called the funeral home, they just came in with a regular car, and our family and friends, we all lit white candles and we lined our hallway and our front stairs with white candles. It was evening. It was October, so it was sort of dark. It was about 7 at night, and there was about 25 of us, and we just lined the pathway with candles. And then Amy wrapped her in a white blanket and carried her out to the funeral home's car and just placed her in the back seat in the lap of a funeral director. And then we all stood outside together with our candles, and we all held hands and we watched the car sort of drive down the street. And then when the car had disappeared, we broke open some wine and we cheers the stars in the sky, and people who smoked started to smoke, and we tried to lighten the mood a little bit and make it into a celebration that she had died so well and so nicely.
As someone who grew up in the funeral industry, I want to thank you for insisting that things be done your way, because I think slowly things are changing. But you just took what we do here in North America. We sterilize death. We cover it up, literally, in a body bag. We hide it. And you brought so much light into this, literally.
Yeah, it didn't make sense to us to take a life that was so bright and beautiful and unique and then just hide it in a black body bag and throw it in the back of a van. We couldn't do it.
No.
That's not how we wanted our last picture of our daughter to be. And we're very lucky that the funeral home was open-minded and worked with us, because they could really have easily said, well, sorry, that's not how it's done here in North America.
Yeah, yeah. What was her funeral like?
It was awesome. It was really cool.
You can't say that. That's not cool. You can't say that the funeral of your daughter is awesome. You can't say that.
You can.
Okay.
Because, you know, of course, you don't want somebody to die. I didn't want my daughter to die. There's people out there who don't want their husbands or wives to die, or their parents or their spouses, but everyone's going to die. And we wanted to make sure that Stella's funeral was reflective of Stella's life and her personality. And, you know, as I told you a little bit, she was really energetic and she was really a spitfire. So we had about a week after she died, we had chosen cremation, which gave us a bit more time, and we planned this funeral, and we decorated the entire funeral home with like her bedroom, basically. We just emptied it out, and so we had stuffed animals, we had posters, we had her favorite TV shows playing on the screens. And we, the funeral home, actually, she was obsessed with chocolate Timbits, and my father would buy her 3 chocolate Timbits every single day of her life. And the funeral home bought 500 chocolate Timbits and put them on this massive table. So all these like toddler friends of hers were stuffing their faces with chocolate Timbits, which was awesome. They were on a sugar high.
Good thing Tim wasn't there.
Yeah.
Right, Tim?
Oh, darn it.
He thinks that they were named after him.
Yeah, just named after me.
Well, Stellabits, that's what we called them.
Nice.
But the funeral service itself, we infused everything we could think of. We had music, we sang camp songs, like a cappella. We had everybody standing and clapping and singing, and we danced, so we read stories, we did a guided meditation. You know, Amy and I both spoke. Amy's mother read a story to everybody. We had tons of kids there, so we had like a kids' room and we had coloring. And the space was there were so many people there, but it was so intimate and it was so beautiful. And you know, everybody laughed together and cried together and clapped together, and it was just so inspiring. For me and for Amy and I to enter this space and to really feel like Stella's spirit was there. you know, it's hard to imagine when you walk into a funeral home that it could be anything but just sort of like old, musty, dated. But, you know, we were able to just fill every corner of the room with her essence and with her energy, and it ended up like it was cool. It was almost like we didn't want it to end because it was really, really beautiful.
What would you do differently?
Her funeral?
Yeah. Her funeral, the way she left, the way you handled things once that pronouncement came down, once the diagnosis, from the diagnosis to her funeral, what would you have done differently now that you've had a few years to look back?
No, I think the only thing that I would have done differently, or that I wish we realized earlier, I mean, 99% of the stuff, I think we nailed it. Like, we were happy. She was happy. The only thing is, I wish that I had never stressed about if she was as devastated as we were. So, for example, when she first lost her ability to walk, I remember, you know, like breaking down and crying in a ball in one of our good friend's bedrooms. And the friend came up and was like, "Why are you crying?" And I said, "Didn't you just see Stella tried to walk and she fell down?" And my friend said, "Yeah, but then she just crawled over to the play kitchen and she's down there happily playing with her friend. She doesn't even, like, she wasn't affected by it. She doesn't care. She's still playing down there. She didn't even miss a beat. She just found her own way to get over there and did it." And so I feel like I wish that I could have just enjoyed every single moment instead of every time she lost something, like grieving it. But that was my grief, not hers.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know?
And you and I are similar, very similar that way. That's exactly what I would do. I know a few people who would be able to see the bright, shiny thing, light behind everything, and it's I would look at that and I would be on curled up in a ball in the same room with you, sobbing at that moment. I just anyway.
And it's not, you know, I don't excuse it. I was devastated, but the thing is, it was my grief, not hers, I never wanted to push that grief onto her. She really was like, whatever, I'll just, you know, get over there a different way. I'll just roll over, and now I'm here where I wanted to be playing with my friend anyway. So there you go.
I'm assuming that we're running out of time here. I hate this. Yeah. This is the downside of these kind of conversations. There shouldn't be a clock on it, but it's radio and there is.
I'm running out of time too. My children are about to like drown in the pool.
You can't say that. Jeez. Okay, bye.
I'm kidding.
Oh,
there's
man.
An elderly neighbor watching them.
Okay, all right.
That's next week's show.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay, so you can't go through, I don't think anybody, even a self-proclaimed atheist, cannot go through something like this and not have it impact them spiritually or, you know, internally in such a profound way. And I already know that there's God stuff going on in your life.
Mm-hmm.
So how has this impacted you spiritually? Yeah, I kind of told you how I'm thinking it might impact me, but that's just because I'm a jerk. Apparently you're not.
No, I'm a total jerk.
Okay.
No wonder we get along. Yeah. I think that the biggest change for me spiritually has just been, you know, I always went to church and I still go to church, but I don't live and die by any books or any, you know, any sayings that people tell me. I just, you know, I believe that there's something out there. I believe that there is something bigger that's looking after us all, but I don't speak to anybody specifically. I don't ask for anything. You know, I don't pray for something for myself, because I think the one thing this experience has taught me is, you know, you don't have as much control over things as you would like to think.
Yeah.
And instead of asking for things, the only thing you can do is just ask for the strength to get through the things that you're given. So, you know, it's just a different way of looking at things. I think before this, I would have said that I was, you know, spiritually, I, you know, believed in certain things. And now I just, you know, my belief has just become a little bit larger. It's more on a macro scale than a micro scale.
Really well said. Interesting. Well, if there is a God, I think that God gave Stella to you guys. No, I don't know. I'm glad God gave Stella to you guys is what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and I'm not saying God only gives you what you can handle, and so he knew you guys could handle it, so he gave Stella, you know. And I'm certainly not saying God gave Stella a brain tumor. I'm not saying that. I am saying, thank God Stella had you guys.
Thank you. Yeah, I think, you know, I think that everybody benefited from having Stella. Myself and Amy and our family, and I think that really and truly we've all become better people, and we have realized what's really important. I do not get angry at the Tim Hortons line any longer. I do not get frustrated in traffic. So, you know, we've learned what's really important, and I think that that's a wonderful gift that Stella gave everybody.
Man, I am so excited to come down the river in my boat and pick you and your wife and your kids up and go for a spin.
Well, thanks. I'm excited, too. I can't wait. I hope the boys don't pee off the side of your boat. They do that.
I hope they do. That would be awesome. Just be warned, Drew will probably join them.
You just kind of wrecked the whole thing there. Okay.
Sorry.
Michelle, thank you. Thank you again for sharing your story again.
Well, thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate the time and speaking to her and also asking questions about spirituality, which is a different angle, something I don't often get asked, so I appreciate that very much.
Good, good. Well, that's why it worked. Michelle, have a great weekend.
You as well. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. Well, this is why we only do journey segments every once in a while, because it seemed to kind of mess people up in the studio. Good thing we have a giant roll of toilet paper for Jen, who's still here sobbing in the corner.
Yeah.
How do you not get impacted by that stuff? You know, I mean, good night. Anyway, you know, growing up in the funeral business, you can become desensitized very easily, but you never get desensitized at the small white caskets. No, you never do.
You can't.
We'll be right back.
Just a part of it. We've got to fulfill the book. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause I